listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, Asheville's premier soccer podcast.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of You're Smarter Than Us. I'm very excited to welcome Megan Burke onto the podcast today. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Tim.
Awesome. Guys, Megan Burke is, I mean, across the country, she has had an impact on the women's sport. But let's kind of go back to the beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about your start in St. Louis, St. Louis University, and how you became known as the Burkinator?
You really did do your research. Well, I was born and raised in St. Louis, and I actually was just there this past weekend with our four-year-old son visiting family. So I am tried and true St. Louis. I'm a Cardinals fan, you know, several generations deep, and it has a very, very, very rich soccer community. History and tradition. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but the U.S. men's team that beat England in the 1950 World Cup, out of their starting 11, five were from St. Louis and actually grew up in the same few blocks radius on the hill. So I grew up playing club soccer for JB Marine and ODP and all that stuff, and thought that I would go away for college, and kind of was surprised and delighted when St. Louis U just felt like the right fit for that stage in my soccer career. And so I was really fortunate to land at a place where I got to help build a program. And you look at them now, we just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the program in 2016. And you know, it's a great program. Katie Shields is the head coach now. Tim Champion was there for many, many years, my coach. And he tended to cultivate this ethic of, you know, we played attractive, possession-oriented soccer, but we were also a little blue collar, hard-nosed, hardworking, you know. And I remember Kathleen Shager, who was the youngest of 14 kids, grew up in Chicago, was the one that gave me the nickname Burkinator. And I think it was because I actually remember, I think it was a shooting drill. Freshman, sophomore, I mean, I just couldn't get enough of training. And so I'd go with the forwards, I'd go with the defenders, and I'd practice as long as they'd let me. I hope it's not an NCAA. But, you know, I was on the field for like four
statute
times.
Of limitations.
Yeah, exactly. Way past that. And I remember, I think she just was like, it just came out. She was like, yelled Burkinator one day, and it stuck. So, yeah.
So you're named Player of the Decade for that year. And then you actually got drafted into, what was the Women's League at the time called?
I did. That's a great question. So that's actually how I moved to North Carolina. I was a second round draft pick by the Carolina Courage in the WUSA was the name of the league. And that was the league that was founded on the heels of the 99 World Cup that was hosted here in the U.S. You know, was it 99,000 fans at the Rose Bowl at the final?
You know, Brandi Chastain.
Brandi Chastain took her shirt off, right. So that league was around from 2001, 2002, and 2003. It lasted 3 years. I was drafted in 2003. You know, I remember watching with my family in my apartment at SLU, and was honestly shocked that I got picked up in the second round, a lot higher than I expected. And that was my first reaction. And my second reaction was, where is Cary, North Carolina? I, you know, had been to North Carolina several times for soccer, but was not super familiar with the state. I knew about the Triangle, of course. But, you know, if it's any indication how ignorant I was at that time in 2003, after the season, I coached in coached at Duke University as a goalkeeper coach, and I lived in Chapel Hill, so I would wear my Duke shirt home to my apartment in Chapel Hill, and I can see the grimace on your face. What a rookie mistake that was. I quickly learned to keep another shirt in my car. But yeah, it's the WSA was the first fully pro women's league, and just it was a tremendous experience, you know, getting to play with Carla Overbeck, who played against Mia Hamm. You know, that was Julie Foudy. Abby Wambach was a rookie. And then that league folded. And there was a few years span while it was rebuilding, trying to figure out what to do next. And I'm sure we'll go through all that. But and then the next league was the WPS. That was around 3 years. That folded. Now we're with the NWSL, which just celebrated the sixth season.
So this is an interesting thing because I knew about this, had proceeded to forget about it, and then remembered it. What exactly was the Asheville Splash?
I'm so glad you asked. So, you know, my partners with Asheville City, Stacy Enos and Lydia Vandenberg, were huge parts of the Splash. Mm-hmm. Steve Woody was the owner. Steve Woody is still very much in the community, you know, Vadim Technologies. And he kind of birthed this whole concept that Asheville City is now kind of enjoying the fruits of years later. So Asheville Splash was a W League team. You know, sort of lowercase SP, semi-pro. W League was a league that was around for 25 years before it folded. It was part of USL. It was between WSA and WPS, which is why I gave you that timeline, the highest level of women's soccer in the U.S. I got to play for several teams in the W League. And the Splash, you know, when the Courage folded, Steve called me and said, why don't you come out and play in the mountains? And I knew so little about North Carolina, I was like, there's mountains. I had no idea. You know, I imagined this, like, you know, one post office, one bar kind of deal. And I was like, well, okay. And I got here and instantly, you know, fell in love with the community. I met my wife here that year. So the Splash was around for a few seasons and really had a tremendous support and following in the community. Played up at Memorial Stadium and over at UNCA. And, you know, it was just a really wonderful thing that unfortunately folded. I think it was 2004. Well, 2004 was the last season, I think. And then, you know, Steve was kind of a one-man show doing it all himself. I remember Steve would literally get out there early and be setting up field boards all by himself.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, set up the concessions. He was, you know, getting our gear. I mean, he and his family, Cindy, you know, their kids were just tremendous. And just not, you know, that's a lot to put on one family. And
yeah,
so
seeing, having gone learned to one of the Asheville City games very early and seeing the how the men's team helps set up for the women's games
right.
and the women for the men's, but also seeing the amount of volunteers. I can't imagine one
Isn't that amazing? I mean, he's superhuman. Yeah, he did tremendous things with it. Yeah.
So after that season with the Splash, you went overseas.
That's right.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Bristol Rovers?
Oh, man, it was such an awesome experience. So I went over late 04 to 05, and we were probably one of the best teams in the women's, it was then called the Women's Premier League. In the past 14 years, you know, now they have the Super League. It's just a totally different look. But I had a friend, I mean, really, I think it's still somewhat true, but certainly back then, you know, in between leagues folding and whatnot, it was sort of a whisper campaign to find out where you could go next. And so the challenge was always the work visa. But the year before that, I'd gone over to England and tried out with Arsenal and Leeds United. Had an awesome experience, but we couldn't sort out. It was this complicated thing where it was like, it's not fully pro, so you can't get a work visa, but, you know, you can't do anything else, so you can't get another kind of visa, and you're kind of caught in the middle of this thing. So we got it sorted out. I was able to go over in 04, 05 and play, and we made it to the FA Cup semifinals. Lost to Charleston in the semis and got to play in front of, you know, I think it was 3,500 fans, something like that.
That's amazing.
It was great. It was just playing in a country that loves the game like they do is, I think, every soccer lover's kind of dream. So it was a neat experience.
And then you kind of bounced around a little bit. Boston, Chicago, Sky Blue.
Yep.
What was it like moving through those cities in this kind of tumultuous, you know, leagues are closing, teams are folding, moving?
Yeah, I sort of joked with Ryan when we first started talking to Asheville City. I said, you know, every team I played for is right after I played for him, right? Which is almost an automatic disqualifier. So, yeah, I, you know, there's so many. There's this great book that my friend Gwendolyn Oxenham wrote called Under the Lights and in the Dark, Untold Stories of Women's Soccer. And I think there's just this awesome generation of players who, prior to NWSL, you do, and I mean, you love the game so much and you do anything to play. And so in the moment, it's like, yes, it's tenuous. You know, my wife jokes, she's like, my God, every week you could call, hey, there's a, they need a goalkeeper in Japan. Hey, in Switzerland. Hey, in Iceland. You know, I was briefly on the Irish national team until they found out I actually wasn't totally Irish. I mean, I've got some crazy stories and that's the fun part of it. I mean, especially now as a lawyer, you know, with a real job, it's like those days are, I wouldn't trade them for anything. I had a cardboard box for a coffee table when we met, you know, when I submitted my bar application, I had like 29 addresses in 11 years, you know? So, but that, you know, yeah, I got to chase a dream and what a special thing and what a privilege. So, what that meant was that, I came back from England. I was planning on playing in Vermont. Circumstances changed, so I ended up staying here in Nashville because, again, I just love the town. Went back to St. Louis, worked for an investor who was trying to get an MLS expansion team in St. Louis, Jeff Cooper. Worked for him. He also owned and started a WPSL team, so I played for River Cities FC. Was with them for 2 seasons. Again, folded, but a tremendous run. Then I, you know, after my experience in England, someday maybe over a beer, I'll tell you the real story about why I went to law school. But it had something to do with something that happened in England. And I was like, I just decided, you know, there's the answer you give in your law school application, and then there's the real answer. And I just was like, you know, I'm going to law school. I'll just, you know, throw some applications in and see what happens. Well, it turned out, you know, I got into some places, and my wife on a lark decided to apply to divinity school and got in to Harvard. I got into Northeastern. We decided to move to Boston. So that's what drove the move to Boston. Of course, I played for the Boston Renegades there. So I played while I was in law school. I then had planned to come back and play in WPS in 2009. It was the first year of the league. I've been training for that. And just on the eve of the draft, found out I had a spinal injury. So I had to get spinal fusion and discectomy, which meant, you know, it was a pretty serious injury, pretty serious recovery. Wasn't sure if I'd get to play again, but I was determined to do it. So I took a year off of playing, continued his rehab, train, you know, try to come back from that. I had an incredible, Katie Shields, the head coach at SLU, was actually the goalkeeper coach at Harvard when I was in law school at Northeastern and coming back. And the head coach there, Ray Leone, had been my ODP Region 2 coach when I was like 14, and he was the head coach. And I called Ray. I was like, "Do you remember me?" He said, "Of course." You know, it was crazy. It's just what a small world, and, you know, how long and deep these relationships go. And he said, "Come on out. We'll help you come back, you know, train." And Katie just took me under her wing. I had a long way to go to come back from that surgery. And so I spent all of 09 doing that. And then in 2010, I went out on the tryout circuit, ended up landing on, hooking up with Chicago, stayed there for a while. But then there was an opening in New Jersey. I was able to sign with New Jersey, and, you know, starting goalkeeper got injured and I got in, finally got to play. So that was a pretty big moment for me. And that's how I kind of landed. So.
And that Sky Blue was your last professional team that you played for?
Yeah.
So going from St. Louis to Sky Blue from 96 to 2010-ish, 2011-ish?
I started college in 99. I don't want to date myself too much. But
how did you see the sport change in that time period?
We've probably only got so much time. We could talk forever about that. I mean, you know, it's funny. One thing that I will comment on that really struck me was I remember going to training with the Bristol Rovers. I trained with the boys in their academy system. And I would have been 24 that year. You know, when you were a kid playing with boys, there's always kind of the boys girls dynamic and whatever. And I remember going to this session with these young boys who were, you know, teenagers, early 20s. And they were so cool. They were just like, you know, I'm a goalkeeper. There was no gender dynamic at all. And with goalkeepers, I think that's particularly true. That was the first hint to me that something was shifting. Something felt different. I remember going to the gym doing these training programs that our strength coach at SLU had given me that involved Olympic lifting, you know, power cleans and hang cleans. And at that point in time, it was pre-CrossFit, you know, people were like, "What are you doing?" You know, people would come check on you at the gym like, "Are you okay?
Shouldn't you be running cones?
what is this?" And that evolved too. You know, over the next couple of years, you started seeing people who like just were so comfortable seeing women train hard and, you know, dig into their sport and men and women training together. And right around 04 to 07 was when I was like, something's shifting here. And it's pretty awesome to see. And I think that sort of that was the beginning of what we're seeing now, where I think, you know, people just love to watch beautiful soccer. You see it with Asheville City, right? I mean, our attendance was awesome this summer.
10th best in the country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think in our community, people just love watching high level soccer. They like watching great athletes. And we're starting to see a shift in our culture around, are you a men's fan? Are you a women's fan? And it's like, no, actually, I'm just a soccer fan. I love Asheville City. I want to come out and see good soccer. And that distinction is starting to fade a little bit.
And do you think specifically in America, that's because Americans are becoming more knowledgeable about the sport? Because, I mean, you know, follow the money.
women's soccer isn't making money yet. But there seems to be these continual attempts to create these leagues and invest in these leagues. And do you think that's kind of, that's the carrot that's going to get the horse to enjoy the sport?
I think that we're actually, as a country, I think past the point where at the beginning of stages of learning the game, I think our soccer IQ is actually a lot higher than we get credit for. And I also think there's exceptions to the view that women's soccer wasn't making money. I mean, Portland, Orlando, Utah, Asheville. You know, you look at these clubs and the difference is less to do, it has more to do with the owners and how they approach the investment. Like, are you willing to spend money to make money and treat this like a business? Or is this a charity in the ponytail posse, which was the whole WSA shtick that failed, that didn't work, right? And I think what we're seeing is a lot, you know, a more serious approach to women's soccer as a business and as an investment, something that's has a lot of potential. And so in the response to that in the fans, I think, has been met in kind, right? Like, I mean, I don't know exactly how many season tickets we sold this summer, but you bought one jersey, one season ticket to get into all games. And I think our fans love that. I actually wondered, I was like, that is a lot of games in a short span of time. You know, are we going to have some fatigue, or are people going to have a hard time getting the kids together or whatever? Not at all. I mean, people are just excited to have games to go to. And I think fans are embracing, especially here in Asheville, the soccer IQ is high. People understand high-level soccer. They're embracing just the opportunity to see more soccer and to see it done right and to see it done at a high level. And so I think when you look at, you're absolutely right that there are clubs in NWSL and elsewhere that are still struggling. And I think some of that has to do with the approach. But if you look at Man City, PSG, I mean, there are examples around the world where women's soccer is a profitable business. And part of that has to do with how it's run.
So this next little bit we'll cover in two separate parts. But the first part being, why on a national level do you personally feel that the country does so well, multiple world championships, et cetera, et cetera, but professionally within the country, it's still a little bit of a struggle?
I think that's a great question. I don't profess to have the answer to that. If I did, I'd probably own the league and run it.
Well, they're looking for a commissioner.
Yeah, you know, that is a really good question. I think I'm going to break it apart a little bit because you look at what the U.S. have done on the world stage, and I mean, it's, you know, we've set the standard, right? Winning three World Cups. And I think we've become, you know, kind of the bar that countries strive to surpass, and they are surpassing us. I think that's the dirty little secret, is that you look at Germany. You know, I mean, even look at, God, look at the Japanese, how technical they are. You know, there are some things, and this is going to be, it is a criticism of U.S. soccer. You know, you look at what they've done on the men's side to try to help the men even qualify, which they didn't for the World Cup. And then, you know, you look at how delayed they've been to invest in girls' academies and the development academies and things like that. There's been a lag, and I think other countries around the world are pretty soon going to start exploiting that lag, surpassing that lag. You know, there are I don't think NWSL, which is a premier league in the world, wouldn't make the claim that WSA did some 15 years ago that it is the premier league in the world. You know, we're seeing other countries figure out how to do that. Why there's a disconnect, I mean, you're absolutely right. When you look at a national team game being scheduled in, you know, Chicago or in the Triangle, those are near sellout games. The Courage are actually doing really well in attendance, right? They play in the same stadium. Portland, again, you kind of have to put Portland, Utah, Orlando kind of in one bracket, and then these other clubs in another bracket. I think some of that has to do with the business approach, right? Like treating it like a business. But I also think, you know, as you know, I'm involved with the Players Association. I think a lot of it has to do with how players are viewed, how they're incorporated into the business. You know, at Asheville City, we really try to elevate our players. We think it's not, you know, despite having charismatic coaches and Stacey Enos and whatnot, you know, fans are coming to see players. They're coming to see goals. They're coming to see saves, tackles. And so I think lifting up players and making them kind of the centerpiece of the club and getting them in the community is a lot of what drives fans to come to games. That's one part of it. And another part of it is you look at, like, you know, Asheville, we got High Wire as a title sponsor. Portland, you know, is a community that's really, it's a downtown urban stadium that's pretty ingrained with their supporters groups. And you got to have kind of some built-in infrastructure to get people to turn out. And I think that's one thing that we've done well. But a lot of that has to do with our fans. I mean, South Slope Blues are the best supporters group on the planet. I mean, those guys drove all the way to Lake Norman. they got the drums, they create the atmosphere, the smoke bombs. I mean, it's fun, right? My 4-year-old has as much fun as my wife and I do, you know, and on a summer night getting a beer, you know, watching a game. There really aren't any better, there isn't a better way to spend a summer night in Asheville. And I think, you know, a lot of towns are embracing that and creating that atmosphere at their games, but some still need to.
So can you explain a little bit, you just mentioned it, what your role is with the, it's not a union, it's a mm-hmm. players association, mm-hmm. But what your role is, why you maybe personally felt like you were in a good spot to partake in that role, mm-hmm. and what the difference is between an association and a union?
Sure, that's happy to do that. So I was a member of the union we had for the WSA, and I kind of, as a rookie, came to understand how important it is for players to be organized. I then helped, for that reason, organize the WPS Players Union as a player. I was a law student then. And I, you know, had an interest in labor law in law school and did some work around labor and employment issues. And so I've had both the player's experience, you know, the shifty experiences with the visas and the cardboard box for the coffee table and some of the headaches that players experience. And I felt like that combined with my legal background, I could do something useful for players. And really, you got to credit the NWSL players. They were the ones who organized themselves, and they reached out to me and asked for some help. So this wasn't lawyers coming in, organizers coming in and trying to rabble rouse. This was all driven by players. So Yael Averbush is the president. She's elected by the players to represent them. And I'm sort of in this interesting role of really, you know, I'm spokesperson advising them. I'm also a lawyer, so I, you know, truly am representing them as a lawyer, but more in a capacity as a former player, having been where they are and trying to help guide them through this process. There isn't, you know, it's interesting because like Major League Soccer is a union. They used to be the Major League Soccer Players Union. They rebranded as the Major League Soccer Players Association. There isn't really, in terms of the nomenclature, it's not really a difference. An association is a type of union. We're going through the voluntary recognition process now with the league and trying to negotiate that. It hasn't been finalized, but we do at some point soon intend to be certified or recognized as a union by the National
Has League. The gradual process been on purpose?
Yeah, actually, you know, I would say the players, you know, in the 5th year, the league felt like that was the right time to get a little more organized after they felt like, you know, the league's more stable. There's some pretty clear issues that the players could be helpful with the league on. And then they, you know, so they wrote a constitution and bylaws. They had an election where they selected player representatives and an executive board. And that was actually how I came in. I'd been working with FIFA Pro kind of on a parallel track, where the players were doing that process themselves. And then this year was when we started pursuing a drive to collect union cards. As best I can tell, you know, I'm not, you know, I was like, don't hold me to it, because maybe there's a list for missing one card here or there. But as best I can tell, we have unanimous support among all the players as a players association. You know, we've had a 1 year of changeover. We've communicated to the league that it's our intention in this process to be collaborative. You know, unfortunately, in the U.S., you see a contentious relationship often between employers and unions. That's not our intention. I mean, we are in this for the exact same reasons the owners are, the coaches, the front office staff, the league's, you know, league office. Small world footnote, Amanda Duffy, who's the managing director, played at ECU. We were like rivals in college. We were both in preseason with the Carolina Courage back in 2003. You know, so these are, it's a small world, you know, and I have a good relationship with Duffy, you know, so I think I know why she's in it. She's asserted, you know, she's basically one of us. She's a former player who is now on the league side. And so we all want to see the same thing happen. You know, we want NWSL to be a profitable, sustainable, successful league. And so that's why, as a players association, we come into it with an approach of wanting to work shoulder to shoulder with the owners on issues of common concern.
So just since the association was announced, I know some things have improved. And I don't know if this was as a result of that, but it, the timeline seems to match up. But also with just the growth of the sport, there was the situation of games going from Lifetime to ESPN and moving more into a primetime spot. And there's been several comments about like what happened to Rachel Daly in Houston and getting out of like the Houston midday heat. Is this something that you guys played a part in, or was this something that you just brought to the attention and the league agreed? Because obviously moving to ESPN in primetime benefits everybody. But when it was a player's health at potential risk running these midday games, was that something you guys had on your radar?
We did. But I think you got to give a lot of credit to the league because, you know, we're sort of, even though this is the third iteration of women's pro soccer, this is the most successful and sustainable one. And so in some ways, they're painting on a blank canvas. The moment they got past year three, this is unprecedented territory. And so, you know, I think there have often been instances where I'll reach out to the league about, you know, some of the issues you pointed out. And they're already on it. It's either something already on the radar screen, or if it's not, it's something that they're very receptive to trying to address with us. And so I've been very pleased with that. You know, I think you can't fix every problem right away, which I wish we could, but we've not gone through a collective bargaining process. We don't have a CBA. Those are obviously things that happen in other leagues that, you know, at some point will hopefully happen in the future for us. But, you know, so far it's kind of been in a collaborative piecemeal process as things come up.
Is the men's union helping you guys at all with some of that?
It's a great question. Absolutely. So one of the coolest, this just excites me so much. One of the coolest parts of this whole process has been that both the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association and the Major League Soccer Players Association have been, to say that they're strong allies to NWSL Players Association is an understatement. Bob Foose and I have spoken multiple times. He's the executive director of MLS Players Association. He's made his entire team available to us. Their attorneys have consulted with us. They've taken, I don't know how much time working with us, you know, shoulder to shoulder on issues that have been new to us, but that they've been there. Because I think you said something earlier, maybe thinks, you know, NWSL is basically where MLS was in the early, you know, mid 90s. So, you know, we're not exactly off target or off course to be where MLS is now. You know, when we're at that point in time, you look at MLS, nobody thought I was going to make it this far. And now look at them, right? Atlanta United's crushing it. I can't wait to get to the game. So, I think that's the trajectory we're on, and they've been tremendous. And then, of course, Becca Rue, the executive director of the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association, has just been phenomenal. It's players supporting players is kind of a beautiful thing, and that's definitely been happening in our case.
Awesome. Well, with all of that said, you ended up back in Asheville. And how did the Asheville City women's team kind of come in? How did you end up connecting with Stacy and Lydia and Jimmy and Ryan? Where did the genesis of this happen?
It's funny. So Stacy introduced me to my wife back in 2004. Lydia was my roommate when we met back in 2004. She was, I think, like a freshman in college. You know, the three of us go way back. Stacy coached Lydia when she was like a little 11-year-old nugget. She's probably as tall then as she is now, but... Stacy played for the Splash, Lydia played for the Splash, I played for the Splash. So since the Splash folded in 06, we had the vision or the hope or the dream to bring women's semi-pro soccer back to Asheville. We've been talking about it for some 10 or 12 years. In fact, I remember we were all in St. Louis. Stacy and I flew back to St. Louis to watch Lydia play for St. Louis Athletica and WPS the first game in 2009. We all went to a bar afterwards. And I remember, like, raising a glass, toasting to all three of us landing in Asheville again and launching a women's semi-pro club. And that was, you know, 9 years ago. So we were mountain biking when Lydia brought up, she said, "Hey, did you hear that there's this group of guys launching a men's semi-pro team in Asheville?" And we're like, "What?" And, you know, we looked at the logo. We're like, "How did this happen?" And we didn't, who is this? I mean, it just happened right under our noses. We had no idea. We're like, "Who is Ryan Kelly? Who is Jimmy Willard? You know, who are these guys?" And so, of course, I forget how I think Lydia got us connected to Ryan and Alan. And I met them first. We went over to the Philo on 70, you know, out in Swannanoa. And they were already kind of, I think it was March before the men's team launched. And, you know, Ryan was funny. He's like, we're really excited to do this project. But every time we talk about it with Asheville fans, they're like, why didn't you launch a women's team? And so they knew from the very beginning, you know, this was, it was one of those things where like they had the, they kind of did it. We'd been talking about doing it. And once we joined forces, it was like, you know, lights out. We said all the pieces were there. And so I feel like each of us brings something necessary and special to the table. We're a group of 9 owners, which is a pretty big group. You know, it's so funny because the 6 of them didn't really grow up playing, but loved the game. And the 3 of us, of course, played at a high level. Stacy played on the U.S. national team in Carolina. Lydia played all over the world and at Clemson, grew up in Brevard. And so I think what the 3 of us brought to the 6 of them was they already had so much going on the business side. And we were able to bring more of the on-field soccer substance. And then, of course, you know, I'm doing work in the community locally and they needed some help with some of the stadium stuff. And so I think, you know, it just was a great pairing to try to launch this project.
So what did you know about the WPSL before you actually joined? Was that always immediately the spot? I mean, I guess it had to have been in a certain way.
It's a good question. Yeah, it did kind of have to be. So I can just imagine Ryan like face palming that question because he knows my history with the WPSL. So I played for River Cities FC in the WPSL. That, you know, was an awesome team, just really, really good team. And again, maybe over beer, I'll tell you the much longer story sometime. We'll have to continue this conversation. But to make a long story short, WPSL, W League had been the premier league. They'd been the better run, kind of really well-respected, regarded league. And WPSL had tried to let everybody in. You know, it's the biggest, they call themselves the biggest women's league in the world. Right before we came in, literally that, like when we were trying to decide what to do, because I had real reservations about playing in WPSL, we were looking at, after W League folded, this other league called UWS kind of came out of the ashes. And it seems like UWS was trying to pick up where W League left off in a way. And they've got, I think, some higher standards, something that's really appealing to us. The only problem for us when we were talking to them was that all their teams are kind of far away from our region. They're up in the Northeast, they're out in California, and that just wouldn't work for us. We needed teams that were closer, just regionally. And so it became clear that WPSL was going to be a better option in terms of travel and, you know, plenty of teams in the area, but we had some concerns about who we'd be playing, you know, standards, things like that. The league was actually sold from Jerry Zanelli to this new group right before we came in. Yeah, so we're really hopeful that, you know, Rich Sparling and, you know, that group, that they're trying to do some things to bring WPSL up to a standard that I think it can attain. It's not there yet. There's certainly a lot of things that you're probably aware of, maybe have questions about, you know, how the season ended, things like that.
Well, hey, would you like to answer
that? I'm still salty about it. Yeah, things like, you know, I'm happy to get into that. Okay. You know, that's sort of things like that. They absolutely have to change. You know, that's not acceptable. And so those are the sorts of things that we hope we can help elevate the standard within WPSL. But yeah, we are looking to play it as high a level as we can, whether it's WPSL or somewhere else.
And so to kind of explain what you're talking about, what is the current competition in the Carolinas Conference? Because I think there was a lot of confusion having seen the NPSL and the teams that were playing on the men's side. I heard about halfway through the season, a lot of people go, are these high school girls? Is this an exhibition league? Yeah. So what do some of the other teams consist of? And how do we differ from that in our squad construction?
Right. Well, so I think it's important to note the way WPSL started back in the 90s was a reaction to the W League, which is a women's league, being run by men and part of a men's league where they didn't really prioritize women's soccer. So it was, in my view, I think coming from a place of good intentions. And that league was mostly focused in California. So the likes of Brandi Chastain, Joy Fawcett, Julie Foudy, those guys were playing in the WPSL. Mm-hmm. So the standard was just bar none, right? Like super high standard. What happened over time is that WPSL has tried to let everybody in. And so there's more than 100 teams.
117.
Thank you. You know better than I do. That's right. In the league. And what that creates is you've got all these conferences. And, it, you know, you can't really hold on to your standards. There's, you know, kind of a disadvantage to being that big. A lot of, I think, youth clubs have decided to add a WPSL team just to have a place to play when their players kind of age out, or even their high school kids to continue to get games. You saw that, you know, there's some ECNL players playing for the Rapids. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there were, you know, I remember the look on a lot of these kids' faces when they showed up at Memorial Stadium for the first time and heard the music, saw the field boards, the smoke bombs, the South Slope Blues, and you can just see they're like, this, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Well, and
like,
then they look across the pitch and see Jennifer Cujo and Lydia and...
Right, Parker Robertson. Yeah, they were like, that's not what Bobby signed up for. You know, it was noticeable. You know, but to be fair, I mean, the Rapids, you know, they advanced, we didn't. So, you know, that's the flip side. Mm-hmm. But... yeah, I mean, I think a lot of groups are doing that. And yet, you know, I'm in touch with some awesome teams across the country. So, like, for example, Chattanooga, Columbus Eagles, you know, we've been talking. Columbus mostly has players who are post-grad, mm-hmm. you know, players who are hoping to play pro or maybe kind of outside. I mean, NWSL is 9 teams.
Yeah.
There are plenty of top level, awesome players who could play professionally, but just aren't.
They need that, like, one.
They're not quite there.
1.5.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just not enough spots for the number of quality players we've got in the U.S. And so I think that's where a second division, you know, lowercase d, could capture those players and provide a place for them to play, which is what mm-hmm. I hope WPSL or something like that could become. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should rule out Pro Rel as a potential, you know, avenue to make that configuration more interesting to fans. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's complicated, it's controversial, but moral of the story being, I mean, I think what happened with our season is that, you know, you've got more dilution with that number of teams. It also created a scenario where only the top point getter in each conference advanced to playoffs. So, like, even though we were undefeated till the very last season by dropping points to Oak City, we now are out of the playoffs, whereas in NPSL, you can finish sixth like mm-hmm. the men did and still advance and have a chance, which makes it more fun, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's some tweaks that need to happen for sure.
And then the team that finished first
declines the invitation. Yeah.
Which then it fell to us. And I spoke a little bit to Ryan about this. What was that like? How quickly did you release the players? And then how awkward was it kind of asking them to come
back? Oh, God, so awkward. I mean, it's super awkward. Are you kidding? I mean, so we started joking, you know, we got the girls together, we talked about it. It was like emotional whiplash, because here we have this, and that's why it's so funny still, even now, what, some month and a half or so after the season, to talk about it, because the season itself was like a storybook. I mean, it's so fun. We just, we're riding high, you know, awesome turnout, great support in the community. I really and truly, at some point in the season, I was like, I'm really tired of beating people 4-0, 6-0. I was like, you know, like, you want to...
The Charlotte Eagles game was almost refreshing.
Exactly. Yeah. That was an awesome game. I was like, I want more of that. I wish the Eagles would come along, you know, with us into another division or league or wherever mm-hmm. we are next year. But, you know, that was awesome. Fans love competition. We love competition. Mm-hmm. It makes you better. It makes you sharper. And so to go from that into then just things, we were, you know, because of the number of games in that tight time frame, we had a few players who were a little banged up. If we'd known this was even a remote possibility, there are players we would have rested, you know, different things we would have done mm-hmm. tactically. So when we dropped points to Oak City, we knew we were out. That's just what we know. There was no indication otherwise. And so immediately after the game, Stacy basically was like doing the, like, brought everyone together. Hey, I know you're disappointed. We're really proud of you guys. The season you had, you know, you can be upset now, but think about what mm-hmm. we accomplished and what you've pulled off for an inaugural season. And, you know, basically you're free to go, you know, parting words. And it wasn't, that was Saturday night, you know, and they're basically like on the way back, kind of closing up the season on the bus ride. And so then they have Sunday off and everyone's packing up and they got college seasons to go to, mm-hmm. jobs to get to. You know, I totally, as a player myself, like mentally you're still upset, but like you go into the next thing, you know, you have another tryout to get to, you have a job to get to, you got family, you got whatever. And so I think a lot of players left town and, you know, basically had made arrangements on mm-hmm. Sunday. Monday at 11 o'clock, we got an email from the league saying, turns out the Rapids don't want to go. Would you like to? I will tell you, it was probably the most difficult decision and the most intense debate that we've had about anything. And so we hustled. And I have to tell you, the number, because I made a lot of the calls through the night. You know, I'm like putting my son to bed and texting players on the side, things like that. the number of players who are like, hell yeah, you know, let's go. You know, the number of players who were ready to go was just so inspiring. We had players who were injured who had no business playing. We had one player who was like, just don't tell my coach, you know, on campus that I'm playing and I'll do it. And we're like, no. That, you know, we value our relationships with these programs and we're going to take care of our crew. And no, that's not okay. I mean, but just to give the fans an idea of how much it means to our players to play for Asheville City, you know, the prospect of going to playoffs, like, well, okay, so what? Maybe this is just how, you know, it didn't feel good that that's how it came to pass, but maybe that's just how it happens. We couldn't get to a critical match. Like, we basically had, I think, 12 healthy players. Hmm. And the games, we were going to play two, you know, potentially 90 plus of the games on Friday morning, Saturday. And, you know, as a representative of the Players Association, putting on that, you know, for player health and safety, you're like, that just, no, we can't do it. You know, and so it was agonizing, really, really, really difficult decision because we wanted to go. And we just felt like in the interest of player health and safety, we couldn't get to a number of healthy players that would protect, you know, to do it right. So we had to decline. And I can tell you that it's already been on our minds that when we go to the annual general meeting, you know, I think the WPSL needs to implement a rule that the first time you turn down a playoff spot, you're banned from playoffs for 2 years. Because then everybody knows the game against you doesn't really matter, right? Mm-hmm. Or here's how the points are actually, even if Carolina Rapids take first, you know, it's going to be the second place team that advances. So, you know, that's, I think that's something that the league has to address. Yeah.
So are you just running it back for next year? Do you have plans for any changes? Does recruitment change? You know, going into this year, the thing that I've heard over and over again, well, last year too with the men's is we didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
Going into this year with the women's, even talking to Ryan about it, he was like, well, we assumed we were going to do well. We never dreamed we were going to do this well.
Yeah.
Now that you guys know, you kind of have a little bit of capital to play with, both figuratively and literally. Are you planning on making changes? How do you recruit
That's a
now?
Good question. Yeah.
I'm going to keep honking this horn for anybody who doesn't know it, that my favorite thing that happened, men or women's, was seeing the WPSL teams that came here, played, and then left their Twitter account saying, I've never played in front of that many people.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
Asheville's got it going on.
That's right.
Does that help with recruitment? Have you had people calling you yet?
We have had some interest. Yeah. I will tell you that, I mean, just the personality of our group, Stacey Lady and I in particular, and Ryan and Jimmy and Alan, is to always be raising the standard. So yes, that was a great standard and I don't think we're going to be satisfied with it. So, I mean, our goal from the moment we launched was to win a WPSL championship. And we didn't come close to that this year, right? We didn't advance the playoffs. And I think this is a team that could have won the WPSL. And so there are a lot of players we want to bring back. I think in a weird way, the way the season ended, as difficult as it was, put that fire in the belly. And we got some unfinished business. Mm-hmm. And so I think for a lot of players, like, you know, part of the reason we love sports and soccer is the metaphor it is for life, right? Like, it is just not realistic to sail through an undefeated season winning 4-0, 5-0, 6-0 and think you're going to win a WPSL championship. And I kept telling girls all season long, we are going to beat something someday, some obstacle, some team that is really going to put us to the test. And we didn't see it manifesting the way it did, but it did. And I think the story continues into 2019. And so it's important to us to have a core group of returning players. So already we know that, and I don't want to call them out because I don't know if I can, but there are some players that fans will be very excited about who are already committed to coming back, who before they even left town, like, please bring me back next year. And we're like, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're going to value that loyalty. And I think there are some new players that we're really excited about that we're looking at. I think our success this year, you know, when Parker Roberts goes back to Florida, when Brooke Bingham goes back to Carolina, when Anna Sumter goes back to Virginia, they're telling their teammates that those unbelievable programs. Hey, I just had the most awesome summer. I had a great experience. You know, I loved the game. It was, that was our goal, was for players to leave the season having kind of a renewed passion mm-hmm. and vigor for the game. And I think we saw that happen. So I'm really psyched for what 2019 can bring. And I think we're going to try to raise the bar.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I hope we'll be in touch soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I guess that's why they call us the Blues. Time on our hands could be time spent with brews. Drinking like tourists, yelling like drunkards, scoring some sunners. We'll win you over. And I guess that's why they call us the Blues.
You've been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, a proud member of the Soccer and Sweet Tea Network. Check us out on social media at @your_smarter or shoot us an email at yoursmarterthanus@gmail.com.